Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. I feel compelled to start this afternoon by just mentioning our friend Senator Sams and thinking that, whenever I think of him, I think of him chairing this committee. And so just wanted to ask everyone here to make sure they keep his family in their thoughts and prayers. And we will get started. Senator Vickerman, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 216 is a bill that's brought to me. I agreed to carry it for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. The bill is very simple. It requests an additional $2.1 million for each year for general service grants administered by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. It also ties these grants to inflation. Madam Chair, I think I'll have Leanne Buck explain it, because I know we got a lot of bills to go through today, and if that be all right, Madam Chair.
Yes, that would be just fine. Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leanne Buck, and I'm the Executive Director for the Association of Soil and Water Districts. General service grants are the base funding from the state, from the Soil and Water District's 91 districts across the state. Current funding for the general service grant category in Bowser's budget is $3.5 million. Of that, $2.1 million for the grants go to soil and water districts. So basically, between the 91 districts, currently they're receiving on an average around $23,000 to $26,000. We are looking at doubling that with this appropriation. And again, this is the base funding for soil and water districts. Districts were formed in the 1930s, and they are part of a larger system across the country. There are 3,000 districts across the country. We have local board members. We cover the entire state of Minnesota. And again, we work one-on-one with the landowners. I like to think of ourselves as the troops in the field for implementing and helping landowners with their conservation practices. So again, districts, we started out with soil erosion. We've moved into water quality. We're part of a network that provides a federal, state, and local appropriations. This is the state appropriation for our basic services. So, again, we're looking at the state's base funding for soil and water conservation districts. And, again, like I said, we are part of a federal, national, and a local process. Our budget from the state comes from Bowser, and these are general services to provide assistance for technical and administrative projects for the districts. So with that, I'll keep it short, and if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Buck. Are there questions? Senator Vickerman, I'll start with you because you're very aware of our situation in the legislature this year. There's a perception out there that we have a budget surplus, but we know as budget chairs that we don't have a budget surplus. We know that as legislators. And so maybe I'm going to just advise everyone who comes in front of this committee asking for money if they have any suggestions for where we could find it. So I'll just throw that out to you, Senator Vickerman, and if you have any ideas, we'd sure like to hear them to try to do some of these good ideas that are being brought forward to us.
Madam Chair, I just come from the same meeting you did and found out we don't have that tremendous surplus. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I feel kind of a little hesitant to even come here looking at this kind of figures. But as things change in this place before May, things might look different. So, Madam Chair, I'm willing to... it's all right with you, I'd move that this would be laid over for possible inclusion till we get our funds. I guess that's what I'm going to have to do with my committee, and if that's okay, then that would be the motion that I would make.
All right. Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, I was just going to note that this bill implies that there would be an additional $2,100,000 each year. That would essentially double the base, even though the bill doesn't exactly say that. I just wanted to get that on the record. I think that's what Senator Vickerman intended.
So you're intending this to be ongoing money that's added into the base, Senator Vickerman, or Ms. Buck?
Yes.
That would be your request. We actually don't have a quorum yet, so I think Senator Vickerman will just lay this over until we get a quorum present, and then we can act on your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for being here.
Eddie.
Senator Sharon. All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Anderson. I am here today to present a bill that will make appropriations for a project in a city in my district, Gaylord, Minnesota, that is a very important project in terms of our concerns about Hollow Lake and Gaylord and cleaning up a watershed district. Gaylord is a small community in Sibley County. The people who work there are an agricultural community. They are a community of persons who have small nursing homes, at the employment base of Michael's Foods. There's an ethanol plant close by. It's a small community, and their average incomes are fairly modest. So they're here today to talk about a very important project to you that needs the state's assistance. Particularly, we need assistance with some money to help the municipality of Gaylord to do some planning, to bring forward a very substantive plan for funding at the state level to clean up this watershed, and to divert water that's moving directly into the lake instead of into holding ponds where it can filter out phosphorus, and to provide a small amount of money so that we can use a cover on that stops soil erosion from moving into the ditches and then again moving into this very shallow lake. So with that, I'm not going to do a great deal of presentation because we have some wonderful presenters here to help give you images and a vision of what it is we're talking about in Gaylord, and I'd like to introduce first Jim Swanson, who chairs the Lake Titlow Committee, and he has his presentation will explain the background and the need of this project.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for listening to what we have to say today. You have copies of the bill in front of you, so we are limited on time, so we're going to I'm a social studies teacher, a former social studies teacher, so to cut things in half is pretty hard for me to do, so I'll talk as fast as I can. The city of Gaylord is a rural community, as was mentioned. We have 2,000 residents, and in the county itself, we have a population of about 15,000 residents. So our county and city really do not have a very big capacity to fund major projects. Our per capita income is approximately $18,000 per year, compared to the state average of around $23,200. That's about a $5,000 difference per capita income that we have in our county and city. So therefore, our tax base is not very high. A lack of funding will simply delay our capacity to make improvements. Our lake watershed is one of the largest in the region, and cleaning it up would have a huge impact on the region and the Minnesota River, which is an impaired valley. Thus far, we have done everything by donations and volunteerism. Funding is critical if we're to plan just how best to fix the problems that we have encountered and that face us as a community. To expedite things, we do have a handout that was given to you that I'd like just to give your attention or point your attention to. The very first handout starts out with the Lake Titlow Committee presentation at the top. If you could just follow that. It gives kind of a history of what our committee has done over the past 3 to 4 years. We kind of went at this at a systematic approach, first of all, to identify the problems of the watershed, primarily the lake. Year two was dedicated to finding solutions to those problems. And year three, or this past year and a half, we have spent most of our time trying to get action from different agencies, both soil and water conservation, our local county, environmental office, so on and so forth. And we have tried to partner with them. We have had educational meetings with just about every segment that we can, from the going to the county fair, going to co-op meetings with the local landowners, to just Rotary Club, Sertoma Club, everything. And through that, we have also created 5,000 handouts, which you have in front of you also, that we created, that was donated to us, time and effort into it, that also has helped to educate the community on the issues that we have before us that basically don't cost money. We have also partnered with a number of people, the conservation groups in the area, as well as Minnesota State University in Mankato, who has been very fundamental in helping us do some research on water itself. Going on, as far as our progress, I think in the last 2 to 3 years, we have raised a huge awareness and educational facility that really lets the people know what the problems are. 3 years ago, we had 40 septic systems that pulled permits. Most of those at that time, however, for new housing along the Minnesota River toward Belle Plaine, Le Sueur. However, 2 years ago, 78 were applied for that were new for redoing septic systems, and this past year, over 108. So we think we're getting the word out to the public to help us. More land is being put into CRP than before. I'm not sure how that's going to go now with the ethanol plants and the cost of corn raising so high that many people may be taking that land back out of what was out of production back into production, but that's an issue we have to deal with. Going on in the handouts, you'll see the next one is a copy of the watershed. It's a huge watershed with approximately 38 acres of land to 1 acre of water. So we have a large amount of land there that we have to work with. One of the issues we're working with, again, are the septic systems that are non-compliant by today's standards. A picture of that is on your next handout. You see a red steel pipe up there. That is basically a septic system that is going into the ditch, right into the roadway. And that obviously is non-compliant with today's rules. The next photograph is a...
Madam Chair, this is a set of materials that's among the materials that have been distributed to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next handout is a photograph just north of Gaylord where it shows a feedlot that is emptying it. Basically, manure runoff is going into the ditch, which goes in the wetlands on the topside of that picture. The next photograph is a photograph of... It's a farming practice where the people are farming, in this case, farming right up to the edge of the ditches, and that in turn will allow any erosion and so on of a heavy rain or snowfall going right into the ditch. The following photograph is a photograph of what we'd like to see done, and that's where we see the grassland set aside away from the ditchway. It not only acts as a buffer for soil erosion, but also as a good habitat for pheasants and wildlife. The next handout deals with the city of Gaylord and what we're doing there. The water has been going into the lake in about 7 different areas from runoff from the city. The city is being very proactive in this case of trying to look into and trying to get it on their plans to divert the water from the lake to holding ponds or treatment ponds in another part of the city that was created here a few years ago. Another issue that we're looking at in the bill is to take care of problems like this. This is a copy or a picture of a intake tile in the middle of a field. You see the red flags up when you drive by. This tile alone is about 12 inches across. A small child would fall into it. We have heavy rain, snow melt. The water goes right down it, just like flushing a toilet. And nutrients and erosion are carried by soil. The next picture is a copy of what one of the solutions we'd like to do as a part of the bill is to go around to the area, landowners, and install, they're called Hickenbackers. They're basically it's a high-riser tile to slow down the erosion, slow down the runoff. The water will still go in, but it slows it down immensely. It's a win-win situation for saving the soil and slowing down the amount of water going into the watershed. The next picture I'm going to is just basically is a study that was made by MSU. I'm going to pass on that for now and let the professors from MSU talk to you about that. The next handout is just a listing or like a budgetary item for what the city is planning to do with diverting the water from the lake to holding ponds. And the last picture is a copy of the, like a plat of the city, showing the X marks along the shoreline where the intakes are going into the sewers. Stormwater sewers are going into the lake, and where we plan to divert them to holding ponds on the east part of the city, and then be treated there and eventually go into what is called Mud Lake. It's basically, it's a wetlands on the southeast side of Gaylord. And that brings me to a close on my part of the presentation.
All right, thank you, Mr. Swanson. Any questions? Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness. I guess, you know, these Hickenbottom intakes, I mean, it looks to me that if you're having a problem with siltation, it looks to me like it's acting as kind of an overflow valve, even though it's not a valve, but has the same purpose. But wouldn't those holes on the bottom of those silt in after a period of time? I realize that's not a bad thing, but, you know, I mean, what's the long-range plan to deal with that if that happens?
I'm not the expert in that area, Senator, but what this basically is, it's a short-term fix, I think, in the long run. It is what is being actually promoted by soil and water conservation at this point. The other way it can be done is to dig the land up around the intake tile, go down 4 or 5 feet, fill it in with like P-rock, come back up with cross tiles, and then fill that back up rock on top of that, and then on top of that put your topsoil and farm right over it like it's not there. One of our members of our committee here today has done that to his farm and has worked very good. I guess we're caught up with the economics of it all. From the landowner standpoint, I can't speak for the farmers or landowners, but I think that's what's happening. This is a much cheaper way to kind of do something to do their part, whereas putting in the rock tile and so on is a little bit more expensive for them.
Well, Madam Chair, and, you know, it does seem to me that, you know, I think it would be good to conserve the soil, but depending on what kind of a drop in elevation you're having, you know, it's not going to be a solution that's going to last a long period of time. So, just that as an observation.
All right. Who's your next witness, Senator Sharon?
Our next witness, Madam Chair, is Scott Sparlin. He's Friends of the Minnesota Valley Watershed Initiative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for letting me testify today on this. Many federal, state, and local resources have gone into the improvement of the Minnesota River over the course of the past 15 years. We've experienced a great deal of progress on several fronts regarding water quality and quantity concerns. However, we still have much work to do in this regard, and we remain diligent and engaged. The Minnesota River and its water quality continue to be the primary focus of both organizations that I work for. The Rush River, which flows right through Lake Titlow and Gaylord, is a bona fide impaired water. It has a profound effect not only on the lake, but also obviously water leaving the lake that flows back into the Rush River. As the Minnesota River pollution cleanup efforts have matured through the years, we have recognized two things. The river is only as clean and consistent in flow as its tributaries provide for, and people, for the most part, are really only interested in local water issues. The good news is that local water cleanup efforts and projects not only result in local lake being improved, but they play a critical role in energizing local citizens to make necessary lifestyle and management decisions which result in ongoing protection of water quality for years to come. By diverting the city of Gaylord's stormwater from the lake and allowing it to naturally filter into the groundwater before reintroducing it to the Rush River, will help control downstream flooding, reduce sediment, nutrient and phosphorus levels in the Rush River, and ultimately the Minnesota River. Let's face it, there's just not enough money to effectively address all of Minnesota's impaired waters realistically. We're just scratching the surface. Last year, clean water legacy money was gone with the blink of an eye. Many of us recognize that good projects were funded. However, the number of great projects that were overlooked under the current system and level of funding was phenomenal. That is one reason why we are here today. Thank you. Your consideration of the passage of this bill is greatly appreciated, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you very much. Have you been able to apply for any state funding or any programs that are available through Bowser for cost sharing?
I can speak for the organizations that I work with in this regard. We did, Madam Chair, and committee members apply for many times for Clean Water Legacy monies. We were turned down. Obviously, you know, the demand for water cleanup in the state of Minnesota is huge, and you know, we just weren't on the priority list that was, you know, given out for the money given out. And that's like I say, that's why we're here.
Yeah, and we've heard a lot of testimony from the agencies about the level of demand for cleanup projects that have not been able to be funded because we haven't had adequate state funding for the Clean Water Legacy.
Madam Chair, if I may, too, just one additional thing. The citizens and the people in the area that I work in, the Minnesota River Basin, are so poised and ready to move on these things and these issues. The time is right. It's now. So I think, you know, sincere consideration of this and in future funding of all of our water quality efforts is, you know, something that we need to do as Minnesotans.
Thank you. Did you have one more witness?
One more witness. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to emphasize that this funding, particularly the planning funding, is critically important for us to be able to get the project put together in a format that we can really talk about what needs to be done and what the cost of that project will be. The final testifier is Dr. Boyce Hoppe. He's from Minnesota State University, Mankato.
I'm fine, thank you. Madam Chair and Senators, thank you. I am here today to provide very briefly testimony that may assist in the overall goals of this project. Dr. Trent Vorlacek, to my right, and I have been on the lake now 7 separate times through the last 2 years in both spring, summer, winter, and fall, gathering water samples, gathering sediment samples, trying to provide the basic scientific facts that are necessary in order to go forward with additional efforts to clean up this body of water. What we have found, as shown in the one handout which has been provided to all members of the committee, is 4 slides. Simply, if we would move forward rather than using the projector to the slides, your handouts, you might see that on the slide numbered 2, you'll see that this is a map of the lake. The city is in the lower right-hand corner, and there are a number of black dots on this map with small numbers written next to them. This is what scientists do. Our small numbers there are, in fact, very large numbers. Those are millions of gallons per day that flow through this lake from its large watershed, and then after a short residence time in this lake, flow further downstream into the Rush River, into the Minnesota River. If you flip then to the right-hand side of that same slide number 2, the numbers shown there, over and under, are just showing the range of values of sediment that pass through this lake. Those values in the right-hand side of that slide, those are tons of sediment per day that pass through this lake. Notice that these are appreciable numbers. Up to 6 tons of sediment washes into this lake during an average runoff event. Approximately 3 tons of sediment wash out of this lake. The lake is holding some of the sediment, but not all. This is a pass-through system. What is also passing through this system is matter that is of concern to all of us. That's indicated in slide number 3. Slide number 3 shows the nutrients. On the left-hand side are the nitrates. On the right-hand side are phosphates. These are numbers that are new to us as well. Scientists like to talk about parts per billion and cubic feet per second, but we've tried to give them to you here in numbers that might be more appreciated by your constituency. These are pounds. 600 pounds of nitrate leave this lake during a routine runoff event. That's the one highlighted by May 17th. Also, during a routine runoff event, up to 75 pounds of phosphorus leave this lake. When we measure these things in the concentration of the water, they're a very tiny and almost meaningless number, 0.7 parts per million. But every second, 20 cubic feet of water flow out of this lake. And it's that combination that gives us this overwhelmingly large volume of nutrients that are part of this system. Ultimately, what this does to the system is shown in slide number 4. Ideally, we would hope for one of these shallow lakes that is both a viable duck habitat and a fishery. But what has happened with this large amount of sediment being held in the lake and the overwhelming volume of nitrates and phosphates, we've driven this lake system into a stable state, which is one in which there is very low likelihood for the invertebrates to be able to be held in this water that are the food for the ducks. Similarly, the oxygen concentrations, as highlighted by the words hypoxia here, oxygen concentrations are so low that Dr. Vorlicek and I are often ducking the carp that are trying to jump desperately out of this lake looking for oxygen. So essentially, that's our story, and we open ourselves now to any questions that the committee may have.
Well, Dr. Hoppe, it just sounds like a huge job to try to restore this lake. I mean, do you honestly think it can be done with the efforts that you have in this bill? I mean, I know you're trying to be reasonable in your request, Senator Sharon, but, you know, this is the level of problems in this lake. It sounds so...
Madam Chair, I believe that this is an average lake in southern and southwestern Minnesota. I think that we need to address lakes like this now while the iron is hot so that we can perhaps develop the means for expanding the style of cleanup established for Lake Titlow to the remaining lakes in southern and western Minnesota.
And do you think that your proposal, all the work that you're doing community-wide, is really dealing with the prevention enough, that you're really getting at the source of some of the runoff into the lake, the sediment and the...
I'm not qualified to answer that question.
Okay. The nutrient loading.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Swanson.
Part of the study that we've been doing, or the work we've been doing, is the education and awareness of the public. And just by looking at the figures that are coming through the Environmental Office and Soil and Water Conservation, a number of people have started to sign up for those different issues has risen a lot in the last 2 years. So I think it is having an impact. The other thing that I'd like to put forward is that I moved to Gaylord about 17 years ago. At that point, you had to fight the people off to get your boat landed in the landing to get out to hunt the ducks and do this sort of thing. Right now, you won't find 2-3 of them out there during the hunting season on the north side of the lake. It used to be just prime land. So as Dr. Hoppe has mentioned, it's not over yet. We're to the point we feel we need to do something soon. It hasn't been in this bad a state for a very long period of time, and that's why we think time is still on our side to do something about it.
Madam Chair, if I may add, you know, no, this is not going to solve this proposal in front of you is not going to solve the problem. It's a piece. It's asking for some very important elements. The $150,000 is very critical to help this community. That's why we were talking to you about the income levels, that they simply cannot raise on their own the money to put together the proposal that's needed to talk about what money needs to be spent in order to create the solutions, the long-term solutions to this problem. So that planning money is critically important. The second is a piece, just one piece of the solution that's going to help divert a diversion through of things that are draining right now into Lake Titlow into holding ponds. And then the third, the small, very smallest appropriation, is a short-term solution to hold back some of the soils from continuing to move into the ditches. So this is a first step. What I anticipate will come from this is a much more substantive proposal that we'll be bringing forward to you in the future. We simply can't get that documented and defined and justified without this money.
And Senator Sharon, the holding ponds, is that, I mean, what happens to that water? Does it just eventually, where does it eventually go?
Able to say?
Madam Chair, the principal problem with the lake is the sediment. The sediment is the carrier for the nitrates and the phosphates that are entering the lake. Once the sediment is able to be removed through the process of a holding pond or some other engineered structure, many of the other problems that you see in this lake may be substantially reduced. What happens to the sediment that is in a settling pond would be the same thing that happens in all of these sort of traps. It would be excavated and then distributed somewhere else so that it isn't, it's soil. It's good stuff.
Okay. All right. And then just looking at your bill, Senator Sharon, most of this is a bonding request.
Yes.
And so we would, I would ask the committee to recommend this to Senator Langseth's committee for possible inclusion in his bonding bill either this year or next year. That's something you'll have to work with Senator Langseth on. But I do see there is a small appropriation in here, and we're wondering if that's something that you could do now, or would you need to wait to see if you have the bonding dollars to do that? Are they independent?
The small appropriation for the tile covers are you talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, $15,000.
They are not. They could be. That could be independently done from the rest of the subdivisions.
All right. And I have one more question, Senator Frederickson. I'm not sure what Subdivision 4 is about. The criteria waive, can someone explain that, or council, or? No. Who drafted this, Greg? Mr. Knopf?
Madam Chair, I think Senator Frederickson was going to ask some questions on this. It has to do with whether or not there's a watershed district that exists over this area. Those are questions I don't. These are the references you're looking at are referred to in the watershed district law, and I'm not sure why this would be necessary. If there's not a watershed district, it certainly wouldn't be necessary, and I'm not even sure why it'd be necessary if there is one.
I didn't draft that. Senator Sharon?
I'm not. I think that when this bill was being introduced, there was some language that suggested that there needed to be some local participatory process that has been waived because of the other contributions that have been made so far to this project.
Oh, you mean a match, a dollar match of some kind? Or this is, would be like an in-kind contribution?
Can be in-kind contributions. That's my understanding.
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon or Mr. Swanson, has there been a formal watershed district formed for Lake Tittrell? A watershed district is a formal organization, and I don't recall that there is a watershed district formed. I think the watershed is controlled by the counties.
You can speak to
that. Scott.
There is no watershed district.
Sorry, thank you, Chair. Senator Frederickson, Madam Chair, right. Senator Frederickson, committee members. There is no watershed district established for Lake Titlow or in the Rush River either.
Mr. Sparland, I just want to say for our tape, we just keep track of who's speaking. So,
say your name.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Scott Sparland.
You're back.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Sparland. Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, could I make a motion then? Or do we have a quorum to do that?
Yes, you may.
Madam Chair, I would move then on page 1, line 14, delete the word district. And delete subdivision 4 on page 2.
Senator Sharon, are you comfortable with that?
Yes.
Okay. On that motion, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
And
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, I'm very familiar with this lake as this. I did represent this area. A previous legislative district, and the lake does need to be cleaned up, and as with all lakes, the problem really isn't within the lake. The problem is in the surrounding communities and the watershed that provides the water that flows into the lake, and I think this is a very good start to address that because it does involve the city, some changes there. It also involves the landowners in the outlying watershed district. Madam Chair, if you're ready for a motion, I would move that. Do you want to move this on to?
Well, we have to. The appropriation piece should stay here, but the rest of it should go to the bonding committee. So I think Senator Langseth has asked for them to come in the form of a letter of recommendation from our committee.
We don't need it.
So we should probably just lay the whole bill over, and then we'll send a letter to Senator Langseth recommending this, if the members are comfortable with that.
Madam Chair, I would. Move that Senate file number 374 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in our bill of subdivision 3, and the remainder of the bill be forwarded by letter to Senator Langseth and laid on the table.
Okay. Great. Does everyone understand the motion? All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
A quorum present now.
Yes.
I move Senate file
216. Yes. Senator Vickerman renews his motion on Senate file 216 be laid on the table for possible consideration in the omnibus budget bill as well. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, next, I think, who is here waiting? Senator Senjum and Senator Skoy. Okay, I think we'll take 244, Senator Senjum, and then Senator Skoy will be next, and then we have Sparks. Skoy's here. He's here, but we'll just go in order. We have this bill. This Senator Senjum will be presenting Senator Murphy's bill, Senate File 244. Members, you should have that in front of you.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Contribute a little bit, at least, even if they don't
have to get.
That's all we have before us. Mm-hmm. This is the last one we have materials on. Mm-hmm.
So later, just a short meeting. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a special honor for me today to be here to speak to Senator Murphy's bill, Senate File 244. Senate File 244 deals with a place called Lake Zumbro, and I'm having a map passed around so you have some sense of where Lake Zumbro is. It's west of Plainview, east of Pine Island, south of Zumbrota, and north of Rochester. It's a lake that is about perhaps 7 miles long and maybe an eighth of a mile to a quarter of a mile wide, maybe wider in a few places. But it is the lake in southern Minnesota outside of Lake Pepin. If you live in our area, and if you don't go to Lake Pepin or Lake Zumbro, you need to go west of Faribault or east of Mankato. So southern Minnesota wasn't blessed with a lot of lakes, and this one, in fact, was one that was created, and I believe, around 1920 with the advent of a power dam to supply electricity to the city of Rochester. Madam Chair, this involves a request for $350,000 for beginning the process of studying the restoration of the lake. A good amount of work has really already been done. I'm going to stop my or cease my comments now and give the presenters an opportunity to speak. And let me just introduce Sheldon King. Sheldon's president of the Restoration, the Zumbro Lake Zumbro Improvement Association. Dean Albertson here is chair of the Restoration Committee. I have Commissioner Julie Oley, a Homestead County Commissioner, who's also past chair of the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. Joe Hensel. Joe is back here. He's with Rochester Public Utilities and serves in the field manager position, and also actually manages what we call the power dam, the electrical dam at Lake Zumbro. And then Bill Angerman, who is a member of the committee and also been very active in terms of his role as a professional engineer, is going to do the presentation. If Bill would carry it away, we'll move forward.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Senjum, Madam Chair, and Senators. What we wanted to do today
Can you say your name as you start?
I'm sorry, Bill Angerman.
Thank you.
What we wanted to do today was give you a background about Lake Zumbro, as Senator Senjum mentioned, and then also provide some information on our project. Moving ahead, we have a PowerPoint presentation today. And as Senator Senjum mentioned, Lake Zumbro is in southeast Minnesota. It's about 650 acres, and it was formed in 1919 when Rochester constructed a hydropower dam. As Senator Senjum mentioned, one of the key things is that Lake Zumbro has the highest population relative to recreational lake area of all of greater Minnesota. So again, this is a real big asset for the southeast Minnesota. The lake, or the map that you see on your left, that is what's called the bathymetry map, or that's depth contours corresponding to color, red being 0 feet of depth up to the dark blue being about 42 feet. And what you gather from this map is on the southern side of that, you'll see a lot of reds and oranges and yellows, which is the area that has been impacted by sediment and is less than 10 feet deep. A little bit about the lake itself. There are a lot of public sites on the lake. The Department of Natural Resources has a boat launch. Olmsted County also does. There's a Christian camp, three restaurants on the lake, a variety of different things. We estimate that there's about 1,600 people use the lake on a peak day in the summer, you know, fishing, boating, swimming, you know, dining, various things like that. Next slide, just to kind of show where you're at, where we are at in the state, and then where the lake is relative to southeast Minnesota. The watershed itself that drains into the lake, there's about six counties. You can see it's about two-thirds of Olmsted County. All of Rochester drains into Lake Zumbro, most of Dodge County. And then, as Senator Senja mentioned, a bunch of the communities within 15 miles of the lake itself. Moving on, we mentioned earlier the lake was formed in 1919. Here's a picture of the power dam. It was added to the National Historic Register in 1991. A little bit about the dam. It's about a 3-megawatt facility, and this is kind of where it ranks in regards to other facilities in the state. So that's one thing that we feel is important is the continued operation of the dam, you know, and basically, you know, the green power emphasis. Okay, a little bit more about the lake itself. You know, Lake Zumbro has a reputation of being an excellent fishery. Smallmouth bass, largemouth bass. It is also only one of two lakes south of the metro area that's managed for muskies. Lake Zumbro and also French Lake and Faribault. This here is just some of the work the fisheries biologists have been doing on Lake Zumbro, assessing the muskie population. That's me down in the lower left. I'm holding a 42.5-inch northern that was netted about a year and a half ago as part of routine sampling. A little bit on the technical side, what you see here is the lady in the canoe here has a Secchi disc. What that is, that's a way to measure lake clarity. And the key thing is, you'll see in the lower right, that's the years with the depth reading. And you'll see that it's trending, and it's trending downward. That means that our lake water clarity is actually improving. So some of the things that are going on in the watershed with the watershed partnership and the different farm programs are we're really seeing an improvement. And actually in 2004, we measured a Secchi disc reading of 11 feet. Last year, we had one of over 15 feet. That's really rare for southern Minnesota. That's something we'd see more in a northern glacial lake. And then before we move on, one last thing I wanted to mention. You see the blue line. That's that's 3 feet of depth, and that's what we now refer to as one senjum. Senator Senjum Senator Senjum told us a story that if he can walk in up to his knees and see his feet, so that's 3 feet. So that's so now this past summer, what we'd say is we actually had five senjums or 15 feet. So
I'm immortal.
Getting a little bit on the technical side, one of the things that we realized is we didn't have any data. So we had those three surveys conducted in the past, 1919, 57, 78. We did not have anything since then. So what we did with the help of RPU is we purchased a GPS sonar unit and we performed our own bathymetry. So that 2005 map was created by us. Through our volunteer effort, and that was real important. You know, if we're going to look at spending money on restoring a lake, we got to make sure it's not going to fill back in again. So I'll elaborate a little more on that. Next slide here. With our data that we've gathered, we were able to kind of analyze the lake and analyze what's happened. The key thing here, two things. As far as water volume, 1919, about 5.9 billion gallons. Today, about half of that, 3.2 billion gallons. But I guess the thing that we really learned is if you look from 57 to now, boy, the rate of decline is really slowing down. And that's really a good thing, you know, that we're seeing some of the farm programs that were really started in the 50s and, you know, the RIM and the CRPs, programs like that, are really helping out Lake Zumbro. And then graphically illustrated, you can again see, you know, the period of time. But again, the most of the damage was done between 1919 and 1957. Next slide. Now this is plotted out, and what we also did is we just extended that out another 20 years, taking into account that there is a watershed partnership separate from us, and they're working on the sediment coming into the lake, and they are working on a 30% reduction in the sediment that will be entering the lake. So again, this is really positive as far as if we're going to pull the sediment out, we want to make sure it doesn't get back in. So as part of that, one of the first things we needed to, again, do from our perspective is we needed to make sure this project was technically feasible. So we raised $30,000 of money with Rochester Utilities, Public Utilities providing a matching amount, and we hired Bar Engineering to assess the sediment in the lake, and that's what you see here, pictures of that. And what we found out is that of all the things we analyzed, being metals, pesticides, herbicides, PCBs, mercury, only two items were found in the lake above basically levels. Only two items were found, arsenic and copper. And what that does is it classifies this as what's called a Tier 2 sediment. And a Tier 2 sediment can still be land applied, so in essence, this was good news for us. We were happy with the results. So we now know that this project is viable to remove the sediment and land apply it. Okay, just a little bit of who the project supports the project, Lakes Umbra Improvement Association, Olmsted County, Wabasha County, RPU, and the Zumbro Watershed Partnership. What we are looking at is through our study, we're looking at to remove 5 to 10 million, 1 to 1.2 million yards of sediment, about a $5 to $10 million project cost. What the portion that we are asking for is the engineering portion of that, which is a $350,000 request. And that concludes, I guess, our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Senjum, let's see. You're asking for an appropriation, not a bonding request. Did you want anyone else to testify? Or
Madam Chair, they're here for questions. It may be, sure. Since this does involve an electrical facility, maybe Mr. Hensel may have comments. I haven't warned him about this, but he may want to say a few things. Right?
He really wants to, we will listen. But we won't force him to.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Joe Hensel. I'm with Rochester Public Utilities. I'm the Director of Field Services for RPU. The Lake Zumbro Hydroelectric Plant and the dam is an important facility owned and operated by the City of Rochester's Municipal Utility. It's an important part of our strategy to meet the renewable energy standard for quite a few years. We produce about 12,000 megawatt hours of energy per year, green renewable energy coming out of this plant. We have invested about $3 million in refurbishing the facility. The civil features as well as the mechanical features. And so the electric energy production part of it is an important part, but Lake Zumbro is truly a multi-beneficial resource for southeastern Minnesota. We really don't have any options. And RPU, the City of Rochester, does own the lake bottom, the majority of the lake bottom. We own the shoreline up to the ordinary high water level in the vast majority of the lake. We want to be a good neighbor. We want to be a partner with the Lake Zumbro Improvement Association, with Lake Zumbro Forever. And so we strongly support this request. And it is just really an important resource from both an energy and various natural resource values of that lake.
Thank you very much. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who the best person to direct the question to, but the presentation, you mentioned that apparently most of the sedimentation occurred from the time the dam was built to about 1957. And the question I have is it clear yet what is the cause? In other words, if you go through the effort of dredging the sediment out, is the sedimentation just a function of having a dam in the river, and is it going to come back, or are there other things that would make this a sort of one-time fix and prevent it from occurring into the future? Any knowledge on that?
Who would like to answer? Go ahead, please.
Again, Bill Angerman. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. We believe that the most of the region is an agricultural district. The primary two areas are Olmsted County, Dodge County, which is the vast is ag. So most of the sediment is from runoff from from agricultural purposes. Some also from the City of Rochester. But again, we think the things that have occurred with the NPDES National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Stormwater Program has really reduced the sediment load, as the various farm programs.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, and to any of you, are you going to essentially dredge this to its original depth before it was sedimentation lowered the lake?
Madam Chair and Senator, Bill Angerman again. We would not dredge it to its original depth, but we would bring out about 1 million yards, but not all of it. We have determined that it's probably not feasible to remove all of it, so the idea would be that we would remove what is economically feasible.
I should have asked the last presenter, Senator Sharon, this question. Was she was taking out her watershed district and was saying there wasn't one, and taking a local contribution out. You mentioned some fundraising that was done and a contribution from the utility. Are you in a watershed district, and are you using any local taxing authority to help contribute to the solution here?
Madam Chair, the request here is obviously for planning money and to move ahead in terms of development of the plan, and from there would be to obviously go, maybe not so obvious, but I'll tell you, obviously go next year to the bonding committee and seek funding there. There would clearly be a need for a local share. There's that. The expectation for that is there, probably through a special taxing district, no question about that.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, couldn't this also be bonding money?
I would think it could, because it's planning and or designing and engineering something that would be a bondable project, it sounds like. Would you like to send it to Senator Langseth's committee or take your chances?
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Murphy, as we got into this at the course of the early session, elected to go that route. I probably would have gone the bonding route, but he's chief author. As a matter of fact, we're having a bonding bill drafted to this amount, so we might just be going two tracks here. If this committee can refer that to the bonding committee, that would be welcomed as well.
Well, yeah, we certainly could refer it and recommend it to Senator Langseth. Once we get our final target, you may be disappointed in the outcome from our committee. I don't know which committee is going to have the better ability to fund this type of project this session. It's not going to be easy for either one, but it looks like a great project, and we'd really like to help you. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I'm reading this. If you just read this, you can't tell exactly what they're going to do. It just says restore Lake Sumbro. It could be dredging. It could be water quality. So I would like to amend it to make it say what they intend to do. So, Madam Chair, I would move on line 8, delete the, and insert A, and delete of, and insert project to restore the depth of.
Lake Sumbro. Okay. Senator Senjum, did you get that?
Madam Chair, I think that clarifies our intent, and I would have no problem with that language.
Okay. Council, you got the language there. Okay, great.
Madam Chair, what do you want? Do you want to lay this bill on the table and also send a letter to Senator Langseth for possible funding?
Well, we could do that. It might be better to pick one route or the other, so we don't accidentally fund it twice. Not that there's a lot of chance of that happening.
Madam Chair, quite bluntly, the best chance of getting it funded, I believe, would be bonding, if I understand the rhetoric about the amount of money we have available.
When is Senator Murphy going to be back? Will he be gone all next week? Do we know?
Madam Chair, I'm not knowledgeable about that.
Do you know? Does someone know? Senator Chaudhry?
Madam Chair, I think Senator Murphy is on his honeymoon. He may never be back.
Yeah, depending on where he went. I know. So I think maybe we should take some leadership on this, Senator Senjum, just so he can enjoy his honeymoon and not worry about it.
He's got airfare to get back.
Shall we send it to the bonding, refer it to the, and recommend it to the bonding committee, and then we can always come back here?
Well,
if it's not.
Madam Chair, I think, as we all, and we understand how things unfold, but whether it's this project or any number of other very meritorious environmental projects that you're going to be seeing this year. As we think about one-time money, I think as Senator Murphy and I talked about this, we looked at this as being a nice candidate for, if you will, the one-time money. So that's the reason we chose this route at this point. But if there is a better route, Madam Chair and members, we certainly are willing to take that.
That's fine. We can just lay it on the table if you'd like, and then we can always talk to Senator Langseth and see what his intentions are. Senator Frederickson, do you want to make a motion?
Yep, Madam Chair, I would make a motion that we recommend this for possible inclusion and lay it on the table.
Sounds like a good plan. All right. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Okay, Senator Skoy is next. Thank you. Senator Skoy, would you like to start with Senate File 135?
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
All right, great. Would you mind sharing?
Sure. Senator Skoy, which of your bills would you like to take up first?
Mr. Chair, I think we would do Senate File 135 first.
Okay. The committee has before it Senate File 135. Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and members, just a brief history of the bovine tuberculosis in Minnesota. A year and a half or 2 years ago, a cattle herd was identified with bovine tuberculosis. We had seven herds all totaled that had bovine tuberculosis in it. Minnesota lost their bovine TB-free status at that time. In the intervening time, we have had seven herds depopulated. The Department of Natural Resources has been doing ongoing testing of the wild deer herd in the fall. There have been some wild deer that have been tested positive. We do believe that they are in a relatively small area, and we are working to bring that under control. Section 1 is a governor's request. It's in the governor's budget to continue the surveillance and diagnosis of in the wild deer herd of bovine TB. This is important for Minnesota to become bovine TB, and we do have to assure the USDA that we do not have bovine TB in our wild deer herd. Section 2 is an appropriation that would go to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to help with their ongoing program for fencing deer out of feedstocks in this area, particularly with regard to cattle feed in the bovine tuberculosis control zones. I'm here with Mr. Abe Bogus and Dennis Simmons from the Department of Natural Resources, and if they would want to come up, they could provide some additional information and help and assist in answering any questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Simon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dennis Simon. I'm Wildlife Management Section Chief for the DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife.
Go ahead.
As Senator Skoy mentioned, we are working extensively with Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Board of Animal Health to work with local ranchers to assess their risk factors on their cattle herds. There's 17 cattle ranchers within the bovine-infected area, and we are working with those ranchers to assess their risk of interface with wild deer and to do some fencing around both stored forage and their feeding enclosures. We're using as a model a successful program in Michigan where the U.S. Department of Agriculture is working with Michigan Department of Agriculture to do that very thing through Wildlife Services, and it's been pretty successful.
And Mr. Simon, is this the area where you're attempting to depopulate the deer herd also?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. We have an ongoing operation right now with under contract with Wildlife Services from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to harvest some of the deer within the bovine infected area and test them for TB positive.
And what has been the success of that program to date? How many deer have you harvested?
Mr. Chairman, as of this weekend, I think we had 157 animals that had been sampled. Of those, there were two suspected positives that we have sent down to the University of Minnesota for further analysis.
Okay. Questions from the committee for Mr. Simon or Senator Skoy? Seeing no questions, is there a committee member who would like to move that the bill be? Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I'll move it because I'm trying to find the other money for the
Board of Animal Health.
Board of Animal Health, so it's just part of it. I'll move the bill, and then we'll see for possible inclusion. That's all.
Senator Vickerman has moved that Senate File 135 be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus funding bill and that the bill be laid on the table. Discussion? Hearing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carried, and the bill is laid on the table.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is important for the state of Minnesota, and I just briefly would want to say that the Cattlemen's Association, Farm Bureau, and the Farmers Union are supportive of our effort to bring bovine TB under control.
And Senator Skoy, you have another bill.
Yes, Senate File number 895. Mr. Hart. Mr. Chair and members, this is a one-time appropriation to continue on with our farmstead ring levies program that the state has been working with a number of years. I do have an oral amendment that I would like to bring Senate File 895 into the shape that I would like, and this has been my first stop with this. The amendment would be on line 8. After board, if we could add, and other watersheds, Madam Chair. This was inadvertently left off, and this left one of the watersheds in the Red River area that there might have been not eligible for this, and we want to include the Buffalo River Watershed District. So if I could make that oral amendment.
All right. Senator Vickerman makes that motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And as I said, this is an effort to continue on with the ring levy program that Minnesota has had for a number of years. I'm here with two testifiers that would like to provide some other information to Mr. Deal and to Mr. Finney. And if you would give them the opportunity, I'd appreciate that.
All right, thanks. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Madam Chairman, members, my name is John Finney. I am a small grain and row crop farmer in Kitson County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Farmstead Ring Dike Program in the Red River Valley. There's a handout going around which will give you probably most of the technical details of the past history and what we would like to have as far as continuance of this program. I'll just give a few highlights. I'm also present chairman of the Red River Watershed Management Board, which is a joint powers organization with 8-member watershed districts covering the majority of the floodplain on the Minnesota side of the Red River. The Farmstead Ring Dike Program has been an integral part of the plan to help reduce damages caused by flooding in the Red Basin. Since its inception as part of the Flood Damage Reduction Assistance Program created by the Minnesota Legislature in 1987, over 225 of these dikes have been constructed. Countless millions of dollars in damage to homes and other farm structures have been saved with the help of this program. If you look at your handout, there is a photo of one of these dikes being put to use in the Middle Snake Tamarack River Watershed District. And it looks like a very lonely and isolated place, but with the protection offered by the ring dike, the farm site will remain unscathed until after the floodwaters recede. I have lived in the Red River Basin all my life and can speak to the fact that there is nothing romantic about sloshing around in chest waders in cold water trying to gather your belongings ahead of a flood. The yearly state funding for the program has gradually been decreasing from a high of $1 million in 1997 to $125,000 last year. The Red River Watershed Management Board is involved as a funding partner, as well as the local watershed district and the farmstead owners. The Red Board and their member districts believe that these farmsteads still need, those farmsteads still needing flooding protection should be able to have it offered to them in a timely manner. A recent polling of the Red Board member districts indicated there are approximately 40 structures left to construct. With that in mind, we are asking the legislature for a one-time appropriation of $800,000 spread over 2 years to offer the remaining sites protection from upcoming flood events. The legislature has been very mindful of the problems created by the flooding in the Red River Basin. For myself and the Red River Water Management Board, I'd like to thank you for your past support and look forward to continued relationship of working towards reaching your common goals. Thank you again for your opportunity to give testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Finney.
Madam Chairman, Jerome Deal, Boise Sioux Watershed District, and I'm clear on the southern end of the Red River Valley. John's on the northern end, and the dike situation is the same throughout the entire valley. We started this program in 97 after the major flood, and throughout that time there's been quite a request for dikes, and the watershed, the individual watersheds have had quite a time prioritizing. How do you tell one guy his place will get the dike and not the next? You know, we tried to protect the home and the cattle and everything. We've had some real patient people since 97. I mean, they've waited, they've been on the list, and we would just like to bring this to a conclusion for this round. There may be more dikes way off in the future, but we'd like to conclude the interest of the dikes right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Just for your information, the typical funding for the Ring Dike program has been 50% state, 25% the Red River Watershed District, and 25% local landowner or local watershed district effort.
Okay. Senator Scoy, I'm looking at this chart here of the past funding or what the breakdown has been. Is this, I'm trying to see if this is the whole state, the whole program for the Ring Dikes? Let's see. Or is this just
Madam Chairman,
Red River Valley?
John Finney.
Mr. Finney.
This is the members of the Red River Watershed Management Board, which is only located in the Red River Basin. That would be from Bois de Sioux north to the Canadian boundary.
And this is past funding that you've received from the, I see the state 50% up at the top line.
Madam Chair, I believe that has been the state's contribution to the program from 97 through 2007.
Okay. And we already have the program funded at $125,000 a year is in the base budget. So where you have under 2007, you have $125,000. It's pretty much all going to these programs here that are listed. These. Where would the additional money go? It looks like, I mean, there is still that base budget funding. So.
Madam Chair, if I could get Mr. Harnick to come up and help with some of the details of these questions, I think it would be helpful for the committee.
Chair Ron Harnick.
You'll have to use a microphone, please, Mr. Harnick. It's not a very strong microphone. It can't reach you more than a foot away.
Sorry. Madam Chair, Ron Harnick with the Red River Watershed Management Board. The question you had was regarding where is the additional money going to go? If DNR has a base of $125,000 in their budget currently, our request is for a total of $800,000 to complete the 40 projects that we have interest in currently. So if you were to then subtract out the base from that, that would be the balance that's minimally necessary to complete the 40 projects that we have on the table currently.
Okay, so this is, well, you're saying 800,000, but this bill is asking for 1.3 million?
Madam Chair, that was in the bill originally. Our minimum, once we got all the proposed requests in, were for 800,000 rather than 1.3. So what we have as a request is $800,000 for the last 40 dikes that are proposed to be built, and you can subtract from that whatever the base funding is to the Department of Natural Resources, which for the next 2 years, if it's 125, it's 250 minus the 800, or okay. 250 minus.
And this would, is there, are there any other parts of the state that have received any of this funding? I see a nod. I think you'll have to come up and help us.
Madam Chair, Kent would be better to answer those questions.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Kent Lockesmull, Director of Division of Waters for DNR. There have been some ring dikes funded outside of the Red River Valley, but that's it's probably three. Oh. And the bulk of them, there's been like 250, I think, built so far within the Red River Valley. Where's my sheet?
225.
Somewhere around 200, 2 1/4 built in the Red River Valley and three outside of the Red River Valley.
Okay. And so, Mr. Harnack, I think you said it would you 40 more to finish the job?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And you're just trying to speed it up so it all happen in the next biennium?
Right. Madam Chair, it's hard when you got a limited amount of money and you've got that number of requests. Some people basically have to fall by the wayside and wait. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been rather fortunate in the last couple of years of not having a significant flood like 97, but this is an area that these ag areas are going to continue to see flooding, and it's important to get these farmsteads protected sooner than later.
And I assume we're not building any new farms on this level of floodplain, correct?
Madam Chair, the state's floodplain management program would require that any new facilities would be properly elevated so that it would not be subject to flood risk.
Okay, so we have a limited universe that we're have to deal with.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Someone, Chair. Senator Vickerman, on this point.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Senator Hand had his hand up. Okay, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to struggle with the same thing that you were asking here about the cost and the bill, the $800,000 total in your write-up for the next 2 years. If we're getting ongoing funding of $250,000, that would leave a balance of about $550,000 over the next 2 years. And so if the appropriation is on it, shouldn't that then be $275,000 a year rather than $650,000 a year?
Yeah. Senator Mann, I think you're right. We should probably
unless there's a need for more, I'm just trying to.
Senator Scoy, is that
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, yes, that is correct. When we put the bill together, we weren't exactly sure what the numbers were going to come out like. We took a guess at it. We were quite high. It looks to me like if we had $550,000 over the biennium, we would be able to do the 40 that are currently on the books. I know we do have a survey that shows that there are 40 more projects, and we certainly would like to get those done. Some farmsteads that might not have had full information, and I'm hoping that 40 is a definitive number, but I'm always hesitant to say this is it because there's always those exceptions that do pop up.
All right. Senator Hand, would you move that we substitute the $275,000 for the two numbers, for each of the numbers?
Madam Chair, yes, I move that we amend line 1.6 and strike the $650,000 in both places and replace with $275,000.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you. Senator Scoy, you probably heard me already say, since you've been sitting here for a while, that this committee may not have much of a budget to spend, but we will do what we can to try to help. If there's no further discussion, would someone like to move the
Madam
bill?
Chair,
Senator Vickerman.
I move the bill because I had the twice in my life we flew up there and looked at those ring dikes, so I know what you're talking about. Ordinary person probably doesn't know what those ring dikes are, but if that'll protect them, I wouldn't want to have to put up with one, but I suppose if you don't want water up the top of your windows, you have to go along with something. So I move the bill. Worthwhile. Remember the gloom and doom we did here earlier? We're still going to be here till May, so maybe a miracle will happen.
Maybe a miracle will happen, and money will fall down from the sky. All right. Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 895 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus funding bill. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, Sparks is here. Okay, Senator Sparks.
We don't have any money for you.
And I just got a bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and it's my pleasure to be here today to present Senate File 941, a bill that would help the Elbert Lee landfill remediation construction costs. I'm going to give you a little background, then I have a couple testifiers I'd like to give some more information on it. But Edgewater Park is located in Elbert Lee, Minnesota, along Fountain Lake, and it's the pride of the community. This is a 63-acre park that offers shelters, horseshoe courts, a softball diamond, and a public boat landing. However, within a few yards of this beautiful area is a site of the old Elbert Lee dump. The former dump is contaminating the groundwater, which is discharging not only into Fountain Lake, but is also seeping up to the surface. In 2006, we worked very hard, and the Minnesota legislature appropriated $3.65 million for the Edgewater Park cleanup. Since then, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has conducted further studies and determined the total cleanup will cost between $5 and $6.1 million. So today we're here to give you a little bit more background and ask that you support the $2.5 million request that we have in this year to clean up the contamination of the Edgewater Park for the following reasons. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency cannot start the cleanup until securing complete funding. The project entails moving 500,000 cubic yards of soil and garbage from the dump site to a landfill 1 mile away. If funding is delayed, the cost may increase, leading to a higher request in the 2008 bonding proposal. A private company is developing adjacent land for housing, and the city of Elbert Lee plans to use this land for transporting the garbage, thus a delay in funding may also delay that development. With me today, Madam Chair and members, are the Mayor of Elbert Lee, Mayor Randy Erdman, and also Kathy Rufschus, the Shell Rock Water Rivershed District Outreach Coordinator, that would like to testify. In addition to that, we have a City Councilman from Elbert Lee, John Severson, in attendance that is of support of this bill as well. With that, I would turn it over to the Mayor.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Randy Erdman. I'm currently the Mayor of the City of Elbert Lee. And as Senator Sparks referred to, the Edgewater Park is really the crown jewel of our park system within our city. The 30-acre site is located on the north end of Fountain Lake and is one of the most used parks in our community. Bayside Skiers Club practices and performs at the edge of Edgewater Bay. From 1956 to 1972, the site served as Elbert Lee City Dump. During that time, the borrowed pits were filled with mixed municipal sanitary waste and open burning was practiced at the dump. After the site was closed in 1972, it was covered with 14 feet of lake sediment dredged from Fountain Lake. The City of Elbert Lee subsequently developed the site into North Edgewater Park. In 1989, contaminated groundwater was found to be discharged into Fountain Lake at concentrations exceeding Minnesota surface water quality standards. This is also an area where contaminants have been seeping into the surface. Consequently, the site has been the focus of several multimedia environmental investigations undertaken by both the City of Elbert Lee and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The solution to the problem is the Elbert Lee Sanitary Landfill is located approximately 1 mile to the northeast of the Edgewater Park dump site. The construction of the new cell, properly lined with leachate collection at the closed landfill, has been proposed to accommodate the waste excavated from Edgewater Park dump site. The Edgewater Park site would be excavated to clean soil and hauled to the new cell. Two-thirds of the cover soil will be retained to restore the site. In order to dispose of the approximately 500,000 cubic yards of waste, a landfill cell approximately 8 acres in size must be constructed with an average waste thickness of 30 feet. The engineering firm has indicated that water quality will improve immediately upon waste excavation. The MPCA has indicated that This is an opportune time to clean up other areas in the city, such as the hot spots at the closed sanitary landfill and monitoring sites at the old Farmland Foods Blazing Star Landing site. And as most of you are aware of, in 2001, we had a tragic fire with the Farmlands food plant burning to the ground, eliminating those 300 jobs. And currently, the city has that site clear title through a bankruptcy judge in Kansas City, and we have managed to level the plant. And now we're trying to look at cleaning up that site also and getting it ready to market it to a developer. And these are some important issues that we have. We are a gateway community. We are starting to become kind of the hub of that area of the state, the region. And we would appreciate your consideration. And thank you for your time today. And I'll turn it over to Outreach Director Kathy Rufschus.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, Ms. Rufschus?
Rufschus.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In 2006, the state legislature awarded, through the bonding bill, $3.65 million to clean up the Edgewater site in Elbert Lee. Since that time, the MPCA and an engineering firm have conducted further studies, and they now believe the total cost will be $5 million to $6.1 million. That leaves a shortfall of $2.5 million. Now, the $5 million estimate is based on two assumptions. One is that we are going to do limited restoration at the park. As Randy said, this park is near and dear to the hearts of everyone who lives around and in Elbert Lee. This is really our gathering place. The community is ready and willing to raise the money locally to restore that park. We've had some discussions with the DNR and between the city and the watershed district, and we've identified this as an opportunity to maybe expand our bike trails or restore some wetlands or do something else there. So we're kind of getting excited about the restoration. However, to get to that point, we need to remove the garbage. The second assumption for that $5 million estimate is that we can haul this garbage across private land. We need to work out agreements with those property owners to haul the garbage across their land. If we cannot reach agreements, or if we lose the opportunity to do it the next year, the cost for this project will escalate. That's because we'll have to move it across public roads and then rebuild the roads. We're talking about 35,000 dump truck loads of garbage. Now, one of the landowners involved would like to develop his property for housing. So if we delay this project, we might lose that opportunity to haul the garbage a shorter distance and off-road. So we're here today to ask you to provide that missing piece here of $2.5 million so cleanup can begin and the contamination can end. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
If I'm reading this right, this maybe should have went, should have, well, sometime we'll have to go to Senator Langsaff. Is that the way I'm reading it?
Yeah, this is a bonding request.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Vickerman, yes. That is correct. And this would be an appropriate use for some one-time money as well, so we'd like to eventually get it to Senator Langsaff's committee.
Well, Senator, Madam Chair.
Senator
Sparks, I know what you want to do, but I've struck gloom and doom since 10 o'clock this morning. I'm more than willing. I'll move the bill.
We did it both.
And hopefully you can... it's kind of nice to have the president of the Senate second author. That helps a little bit.
Maybe he can get us some one-time money.
And I see Senator Langsaff is on this bill. You can't get this pulled off. I might as well give up on that.
Well, Senator Vickerman, I think the motion would be to lay it on the table for us to recommend it to the bonding committee.
Okay, that's the motion I'll make.
All right. On that motion. Any further discussion? This is on Senate File 941. Senator Vickerman moves the Senate File 941 be laid on the table and recommended by the Committee for Inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Chaudhry, is he here? Maybe Senator Kubley, do you want to take your bill first? Well, we'll start with Kubley. He's got someone. I think Mr. Finney is coming back. So. Senator, Senate File 1342, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1342 is looking at funding the mediation project for the Red River Watershed District. It's a mediation agreement that was put in place a few years ago. Back in the days when I was just beginning my time here, you know, we had some flood damage reduction efforts that were really delayed quite a bit due to some conflicts with the state and federal agencies that regulated those kinds of things, and they're being able to endorse and permit the proposed projects that were resulting from some litigation. Some of you will no doubt remember that the legislature funded a mediation conflict resolution process over a couple of years' time that led to the Red River Mediation Agreement, and that was in 98. But that process has resulted in all of the different groups working together to reach a general agreement on resolving the flooding issues in each of the watershed districts. So regulatory agencies do participate and identify problems or issues early in the process so that projects don't get too far along before those things surface. As you know, over the past few years, the funding for mediation work group efforts have been reduced as part of the state's resolution to its money difficulties. The handout that is available, I don't know if it's been handed out, it's one that has the Red Lake Watershed District up at the top of it, Madam Chair and members.
We have that.
But that handout shows a degree of financial reduction over the last few years. It does seem like it would be good to restore some of those reductions and at least accelerate the work of the teams that have been working on this. So with that, Madam Chair, well, I know that you've seen these two testifiers before, but we'll ask them to introduce themselves and make a few comments.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome back. Mr. Finney, or who wants to go first?
I'll go first this time, Madam Chair. Thank you. Jerome Deal, Boise Sioux Watershed, but also I'm co-chair of the Red River Flood Damage Reduction Work Group. And we've appreciated the money that the state has put in here so far. It has got a little tight, but this is one of the most unbelievable working groups, these project teams we have seen in the Red River Valley. We have farmers sitting down with environmentalists. Projects are moving forward. We have everybody together, and it's been a rewarding experience. It's something that's not been shown at all in the Red River Valley before. So it's very important to keep the project team process up, and as of now, the additional monies we need would be in scientific and technical research and monitoring. And the increase, we feel, would at a 100,000 increase would get us back basically to something we could handle, be more uniform with the project teams. We have projects online ready to go. The project team process has worked to the point where, in fact, our watershed, the only thing we're short right now is the land. People have offered us land, and our watershed is working towards that, is that this process can bring a project up extremely fast. And the next thing we're working on, and this is coming down right now, we're going to have the Corps of Engineers regulatory setting at these meetings when necessary. We're developing a core concurrence process so we don't have to go backwards, we don't have to look for additional information, but we're actually going to have the regulatory sitting with us on these project teams when necessary. So it's been a major move for the state, and I think it's a good example for the entire state, the way this is operating. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. Previous bill that we had, Senator Scoy's bill on the ring dikes, are these bills related in that if this is funded, if this flood damage reduction work is completed, does that alleviate the need for the ring dikes, or are they both need to be done?
All factions of flood damage are in some ring dikes remain outside of this loop. This is flood damage reduction. This is more to the natural resource enhancement, to retention projects, and to make sure there's a balance between natural resource and flood damage reduction.
Mr. Finney, would you like to say something?
Yes, Madam Chair. Further to what Mr. Deal's comments have been, not only has this helped the process become more smooth and involve everyone. Oh, excuse me, John Finney, Joe River Watershed District. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Besides what Mr. Deal has been talking about is that we have involved with both the agencies, state, federal, and the projects are now moving ahead more smoothly. We've also involved some of it as public relations. We have a number of high schools involved in river monitoring in conjunction with the River Watch program. It started with a small group in on the Sandhill River in Fertile and is now involved in throughout the Red River Basin, giving us good information. I believe that with the increase or bringing back the funding to the $100,000 increase would continue on with these programs and make it much smoother. Thank you.
Did you say back to the $100,000 increase? I'm trying to understand the dollar amount that you're...
Madam Chair, we've been reduced by $100,000 funding in the past biennium. We would like a $100,000 increase to bring it back to where it was. Is that true, Mr. Deal?
Mr. Deal?
Madam Chairman, we reduced more than that. From 2003, it was $625,000 down to $210,000, and that had to do with a lot of the budget cuts and the difficult situation that the state was in at that time. So some of our programs have suffered, and what we feel is necessary is to increase the base level up to the $310,000, a $100,000 increase.
Okay, so there's not any base funding for this. This is not an... There is?
Madam Chair, it's
Mr. Knopf, please.
$210,000 per year is in the base in this. So this, if they're okay. The way they're talking about this, it would be $100,000 increase above that base per year.
All right. Mm-hmm. And so, thank you. Senator Kubley, are you suggesting ongoing money added to the base?
Well, Madam Chair, I would think that the ongoing money would be needed until the project is complete, and I'm not sure how long that would take.
Well, that's a good question. What's the how long would this project take to complete? Will it ever be completed?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to address that. When we started with the flood damage reduction work group, we kind of envisioned from the start on a sunset on this. But as we got into it and the technical questions that we've had to answer, the work group has kind of been the mediation, turned into the mediation between the environmental farm community agencies. And we've had to start answering some technical questions, which we've taken this money. And, you know, one of the simplest ones was what everybody's heard farmers say the duck is worth more than I am. Well, we found out that through the DNR, we can bounce these reservoirs 2 feet. This is okay with the environmentalists. And we've been making a lot of cutting-edge discoveries to this and getting a process that both sides can agree to. So we're ending up in this longer than we thought because of the questions that are being asked of us by the project teams and the agencies. So, yes, I do envision an end to this at some time where the project teams take total control, but I don't see it as of yet. We still have some unanswered questions. I believe there's been 19 technical papers wrote so far. So.
All right. Any other comments, questions? All right. Senator Kubley, would you like to make a motion?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. With that, then, I would move that Senate File 1342 be recommended to pass and placed on the table for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill.
Okay. On that motion, any further discussion? If there's none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed,
aye.
No. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
And Senator Chaudhry. Senate File 494.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This bill was brought to me by the
Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota. It's looking for a bond issue and appropriation. Many of you have probably seen the Wildlife Rehab Center in the news recently with the expose about the pelicans, and there's more about it in their newsletter here that's been passed out. But I'm going to leave the majority of the discussion to the Wildlife Center folks themselves, Phil Jenny and Dr. Karen Chenoy.
All right, welcome to the committee. Mr. Jenny.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Jenny. I'm the Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehab Center. It's a great pleasure to be here today to tell you a little bit more about the Wildlife Rehab Center and the unique services we provide to the people of Minnesota. I'd like to spend a few minutes highlighting some of the things in your packets. We're a very visual organization, but in the interest of time, I'm going to let the handouts pass for us. And I also have a very nice three-minute DVD that I'd encourage any of you to take away with you and watch at your leisure. I want to give you a little background on WRC. We were started in 1979 as a student organization of the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. In our first year, we treated 40 patients and shared the old anatomy building with the Raptor Center and 4-H, so we were a pretty crowded group there. In 1997, we separated legally from the university and were chartered as an independent 501c3 organization. We remained on campus, but our campus facility was declared partially condemned, and in 2000, WRC started the search for a site for a new facility. The city of Roseville agreed to a land lease on a site in Central Park, adjacent to the Harriet Alexander Nature Center, and in negotiations with the university, we were allowed to stay on campus until the end of 2002. A private fundraising campaign was started at that time to meet our contractual obligations. However, we had to borrow a little over $1 million so we could finish on time and move into our new state-of-the-art facility in January of 2003. In our history since 1979, we treated about 100,000 injured wild animals, and nearly 40,000 of those patients that we've treated in our new facility in Roseville. Most of you are probably familiar with the pelicans, as Senator Chaudhry suggested. However, while they capture the media's attention, that story is actually repeated thousands of times each year at WRC. Last year, we admitted 8,585 injured wild animals from 160 different species of animals. Now, taking care of all that many animals requires a great deal of personnel and resources. We have 14 staff members, including three veterinarians, 40 student interns and externs, and about 500 volunteers who provide about 35,000 hours of volunteer help each year. And we do that all on an annual operating budget of about $600,000. And there's no question that without the facility that we're currently in Roseville, we would not be one of the leading wildlife teaching hospitals in the country. The bill before you is a one-time request to the state for assistance in retiring the remaining $600,000 debt on our $2 million facility and $225,000 to finish some important educational infrastructure. There are really five reasons that we think that this is a high-leverage investment for the state. First and foremost is the public access. WRC is the only publicly available facility in the state that is licensed to handle all species of injured wild animals. About 80% of all the animals that are in rehabilitation in the state are treated at WRC. And the demand for our services has increased dramatically. It's up about 25% since we've moved into our new building. In addition, last year there were 5,000 people who brought us animals. We don't go out and get anything. All these animals come to us. And people brought animals to us who lived in 234 different communities in the state and from 50 different counties. We also handle about 15,000 phone calls a year answering questions about wildlife-related issues. And even injured wild animals that don't come to us benefit by us being here because we consult with rehabilitators and veterinary clinics around the state. Another huge area for us is professional education. In fact, we have national and sometimes even international impact on professional education. In the last few years, WRC veterinarians have begun to play a prominent role in wildlife medicine. Wildlife medicine is a rapidly growing field of interest, yet there is almost no curriculum taught in any veterinary school in the country, including ours here. To address this, WRC and the College of Veterinary Medicine at the university have developed a series of initiatives to help introduce and teach wildlife medicine to veterinary students. And even if they don't go into the field of wildlife medicine, in fact, there aren't that many jobs in wildlife medicine, but even if they don't go into that field, many of these future veterinarians will need to have a background in wildlife medicine, as their clients often look to them as their first resource on animal issues. And besides the public access and the professional education, I'd like to touch on briefly on three other areas where we have statewide impact. Another area is we play a critical role in disease surveillance. There's new health dangers and challenges every day. The Asian flu, for instance, a few years back, the West Nile virus. These are examples of the potentially zoonotic diseases that are transferred from animals to humans. And our large caseload of animals puts us in a unique position to monitor the appearance of such diseases in the animal world and hopefully to contribute to the science that will help protect both humans and animals. In addition, WRC has begun to play a much more prominent role in environmental concerns. We've been leaders in several partnerships, including the most recent Lights Out program that's designed to protect migratory birds as they pass through large urban areas during their migration season. Last summer, we had a highly publicized case where several fox kits were stuck together by an unknown substance. We were able to alert state and local officials that there was a potentially hazardous substance. They came out, tested it. Fortunately, it wasn't hazardous, and the fox kits were later released, but we never really know what we're going to find. Finally, WRC is one of the few facilities in the country that can safely handle wildlife injured by oil spills. In fact, Dr. Chinoy is lecturing on the treatment of wild animals affected by oil and other environmental contaminants as part of a conference sponsored by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And then our final important area is that we provide medical care for endangered and threatened species in Minnesota, such as the trumpeter swans and Blanding's turtles. And our facility has been approved by the International Crane Foundation to help rescue and treat any wayward members of the reintroduction program of the nearly extinct whooping crane. So we provide critical statewide services, some of which are actually cost us directly, but for which we get no reimbursement. For instance, we receive no payments for medical care we provide for species like trumpeter swans, which can cost us up to $200 a day. University students earn credits by volunteering at WRC, but we do not receive any of the tuition money. And then, of course, there's the issue of backfilling. Where else are all these animals going to go, and where else are all these calls going to go? Let me talk a little bit about funding the building and the current need that we're actually here for. This is not our first stop in an effort to raise funds for our new facility. In fact, we come before you as the final step. Our facility is made possible by private support. 75% of the campaign is already been provided by individuals. As I mentioned, we're in the building. We conducted two fundraising campaigns to build the building and substantially have reduced our construction loan. And as you can see, I think on one of the handouts we have the two campaigns, some of the donors to those campaigns. They're some of the leading Twin Cities philanthropists, as well as hundreds of others. In fact, there were about 800 people who donated to the actual capital campaign to build this building. We've raised significant money for an organization of our kind. In addition, our annual budget is also sponsored entirely by private contributions. We receive no public sector operating support. We don't get any money from the University of Minnesota or Roseville or anybody else. 83% of our money comes directly from individual donations, but 15% comes from local foundation and corporate grants. In 2006, there were over 3,300 people who donated to us, from kids emptying out their pocketbooks when they bring an animal in to our largest donor at $50,000 a year. Since we moved to our new building, we've had 8,500 people have contributed to WRC. And we like that. We like the fact that we need to provide good public service to earn our keep. We think it keeps us nimble and responsive to the public. However, the long-term debt on our facility is inhibiting our ability to respond to the growing demands from the public. And we want to be in a position to put all of our growth into taking care of animals and the people who care about them. With me today is Dr. Karen Chinoy. She is a WRC veterinarian trained at the University of Minnesota. She's recently elected to serve on the board of directors of the National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association. And this year she's conducted wildlife medicine courses here at the University of Minnesota, also at the University of Georgia and the University of Wisconsin. She serves as an adjunct faculty at the university, and she manages our veterinary education programs. I've asked her to talk a little bit about her experience as a student and now a professor at WRC.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome, Dr. Chinoy.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Senators. Dr. Karen Chinoy. I would just like to talk briefly with you, kind of share my experience at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center as a way of illustrating WRC's impact on the youth in Minnesota. First, in 1997, I became involved with the organization as I started college at the U of M and soon after began inquiring about volunteering at WRC. At that time, I had already decided to pursue a career in veterinary medicine and was eager to explore opportunities in the field, particularly those involving exotic and wildlife species. The opportunity to work hands-on with wildlife species that many people only read about really fueled my passion for working with animals. Over the years, I participated in the work of WRC in several capacities, and by the time I was a vet student, I knew I would make a career of wildlife medicine. As a student in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the U of M, I was forced to make my own opportunities to further my knowledge in the field of wildlife medicine. As Phil mentioned, there's almost no curriculum at most of the vet schools throughout the country in wildlife medicine. I spent countless hours working at WRC and also arranged for internships at several wildlife hospitals around the country. 1 year before I graduated from veterinary school, WRC moved into the new facility that we're in today. This larger, high-tech facility allowed our organization to blossom into the first-class wildlife hospital that we always knew that we could be. And with the notoriety and increased visibility that our new facility created came increased funding. I was very fortunate that this allowed me to continue my work at WRC immediately after graduation, now as a staff veterinarian. When accepting this new position, I did not realize how much time I would spend teaching others or how much I would really enjoy doing that. Over the course of 2007, I will teach approximately 40 training courses or informational sessions for vet and vet tech students, wildlife rehabilitators, WRC staff, interns, volunteers, and members of the public. I am perhaps most excited to be able to teach at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. As an adjunct faculty member, I give wildlife lectures and also conduct a wildlife elective course at WRC for veterinary students. And it's through these programs that I am able to make opportunities for vet students that I never had. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. I just have to tell you I'm a big admirer of your facility and
thank
the
you.
Work that you do. And my children have rescued a number of critters.
Wonderful.
In our backyard. We brought them up the road. And, you know, birds that fell out of their nests and little baby squirrels that were abandoned and things like that. And we've always been really... They've been treated so well and always given hope that these little the critters could be saved. There was a chance of saving their lives, and so it's really meant a lot to my children. And they raised some money at Christmas time and brought it to your open house for a donation. So it means a lot to them, and I'm sure it does to lots and lots of other children because they really care about all those saving all those little animals. Members, questions? Senator Deal.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. That was very, very good. I was listening carefully, and it sounded like almost all the money is coming from donations or not. Do people ever donate a little money along with the injured animal? Is there a box there to throw money into, or is there any?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Dill, it's Phil Jennings. Yes, we get about $70,000, what I call over the transom. There's a little box at our front desk that people are asked to donate when they bring in the animal. And we get about 25% of the people who actually bring us animals do donate something at that time. And it costs us about $50 an animal on average through the course of the year. And we get about $7 contributed at that time.
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I really enjoyed listening to this presentation, and I think we should go ahead and seriously consider trying to provide money for this request. And I guess the request is, this is bonding money, right? $625,000. So is it appropriate to make a motion to refer this to Senator Langstaff's committee? Is that what happens?
Senator Dill, I think we have a few more questions, but what we've been doing with the bonding request is because Senator Langstaff asked for them in the form of a letter of recommendation from our committee, so is to lay it on the table with a motion to recommend it to Senator Langstaff. So we'll be forwarding that recommendation on to Senator Langstaff.
Well, I'll make the motion now, and you'll be ready when we're done with the discussion.
That sounds good. Senator Chaudhry, we do have an issue with bonding dollars that have to go to a publicly owned facility, so I don't know if you've discussed how that would be done.
Isn't this through the University of Minnesota?
It is. It's to the board. Yeah, it's the money goes through the University of Minnesota, but I assume that the facility is entirely privately owned?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's Phil Jenny. The facility is privately owned, but we're on public land. We have a land lease with the city of Roseville. So Roseville owns the land. We own the building. If something happens to us, Roseville actually owns that building. And that's one of the reasons why we were forced into a construction loan rather than a standard mortgage. If we own the whole situation, we can't have an encumbrance on the building, basically. So that's why we've had to raise it all through private fundraising.
Well, it's something that might take some creative thinking with Senator Langstaff to see if there's a way to do this with public bonding dollars. And there may be a way, but it's going to take some creativity. Senator Hand?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but you asked the question that I was pondering about how we can bond a private organization, maybe there's a way to do it. I certainly think that the work is being done is very laudable, and I'm sure there's a way to do it, but I had some question about the legality of bonding a private entity, and so we'll have to look at how to do that. But that was my question.
On that point, Senator Dill? Okay, Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, and perhaps Mr. Jenny knows the building is privately owned, but the lot is privately owned.
Yes. Publicly.
Or publicly
owned. It's
part
of a park.
Is this money to pay for both? Or is this for the building?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, Phil Jenny. No, it's only for paying for the building.
Okay.
There's no money on the land.
So you don't lease the land or pay?
We lease the land. $50. It's $1 a year and it's a 50-year land lease.
Okay. All right, Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions about. I was reading through your brochure too as I was listening to your comments, and I'm looking. I don't know what page I'm talking about. I circled a couple of comments that I was trying to figure out. You know, with people bring you animals that they found in their backyard, and if they're birds that fell out of a nest. How do you assume that they are injured birds, and why couldn't they just be placed into the nest? And I'm looking at the phrase on the first page where you have mission, values, and vision. One of them says, opposes the mistreatment and abuse of all wild animals. And then on the next page, people who find them in their yards while hiking in the woods or driving on the roads. How can they assume that if an animal's on the ground or even in a tree or a bush or something, that they're in need of being taken to a rehab center instead of just doing what they do wildly? And then the third piece is just, and I'm picking and choosing, of course, under collaboration, the importance of keeping wild animals wild. Those kind of say to me, that's not very consistent. And how do you know that the person who brings something in isn't jumping to an assumption that that animal needs medical service, rather than just being where it was and going along with the family and learning to fly, moving along, however?
Mr. Jenny.
Thank you. I'll start. When it comes down to whether they need any help or not, that's really up to the veterinarian. That's not what I do. But you really have put your finger on one of our biggest challenges is educating the public about when an animal needs help and when it doesn't, and the cute little babies who
were abandoned,
the kids find them in the yard, and then they want to raise them, and it's always a challenge for us to make sure that people understand that, one, there's state and federal law that govern having wild animals in your possession, and then also doing the right thing for the animal. But we spend a lot of time in the spring educating the people. I try to get on television and do op-ed pieces trying to tell people, okay, it's spring, there's going to be wild animals, you're going to be out mowing your land, mowing your lawn, there's going to be animals hurt. Here's what the kinds of things you should look for, and hopefully our goal is to keep as many wild animals that aren't injured in the wild. But once it comes to us, we're not going to, well, state law prohibits us from sending it away again, but we also, as Senator Anderson pointed out, these little kids have a real vested interest in the animal, so we're going to do the best we can, no matter how it came to us. If it does come to us, we're going to do the best that we can to get it healthy and back out into the wild.
So Madam Chair, Mr. Jenny, if for instance, somebody does bring you an animal that truly isn't injured and it probably should have been left where they found it, you don't send it back in any way to the wild anywhere? Continue to treat it with
Madam Chair, Senator,
injured or not?
Yes, we do. State law prohibits us from sending it back with that person, though. Once it comes into our possession, it belongs to us, basically. And that's DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife regulations. But sure, if there's nothing wrong with it, we might monitor it for a day or 2 days or however long, depending on the story that we've heard, and then we release it. And with wild animals, all of the adult animals are released as close to where they were found as possible, because most are territorial. Right. With the orphaned animals, the young animals, we work with public officials around the metro and the state to make sure that they get released in appropriate habitat, and we're not dumping a ton of raccoons in one spot. And, you know, we try to move things around and make sure that there's a carrying capacity. So.
Well, and I have to say, we're kind of guilty in my house of having killer cats on the loose, and I'm sure that's true all over the place. I mean, I know that really domestic cats do kill a lot of birds and animals, and that you're really supposed to keep them indoors, but we don't, and we've definitely brought in a bird that was attacked by our cat that was injured, that was obviously injured, but I can imagine sometimes you get animals that are not injured. But do you think a lot of them are caused by those sorts of injury? I mean, what are most of the injuries that you see? What's the source of them? Do you know?
Well, let me start and then turn it over. This is Phil Jennings. Turn it over to Karen. 10% of our patient loads, so it's almost 1,000 animals last year, are identified as domestic pet attacks, mostly cats. So you're right. That's the first thing when we have, do you want to protect wild animals? The first thing on our list is keep your cats indoors.
Yeah,
but Karen's right at the, you know, hands on with it. So maybe she can talk a little bit more about some of the things that she sees.
Karen Shinoy. I think one very important point to make here is that really probably about 75% of the animals that we get in there truly injured are injured because of the effects of humans. So it's not that we're treating natural disease, you know, situations where the animals really could be left to kind of go through their natural disease cycles in the wild. We're seeing animals that are hit by cars, striking buildings. We talked about the Project Bird Safe were involved with trying to prevent trauma from birds hitting buildings during the migration season, animals being attacked by cats and dogs. So those are kind of real traumatic injuries by human interference are the majority of what we're treating.
Well, Senator Vickerman.
Senator Anderson, don't take that killer cat to that place then. There won't be nothing left.
My cats?
Yeah. You said it was a killer cat. Don't take
it. No, I won't. I promise.
But if you let it propagate, there are plenty of them to go around.
I'm worried, Senator, who's someone at the end of the table is threatening to pass a law against my cats, I think.
I have a question, Mr.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, would you prefer that on my farm I use some very nasty rodenticides, you know, those terrible pesticides? Should I use rodenticides to get rid of my rodents like mice and rats and so forth, or should I increase my cat population?
My cats do the job quite well. That's what I recommend. That's what Mother Nature intended. It works really well. On that note, I think, Senator Chaudhry, I think the committee is really supportive, and we want to recommend this to Senator Langseth, but I think that you should probably talk to Peter Watson before you go to Senator Langseth's committee and explain that you need to figure out a way to have some public ownership in this project in order to allow for the possibility of state bonding. And so maybe there's a way that you could do that because of your association with the university. That's something that will take some more thinking if we're going to be able to help that way. All right?
I've encountered this situation before, so we pass it on to the bonding committee. We can try and figure something out.
All right. That sounds good. Well, then we'll go back to Senator Dill's motion that Senate File 494 be laid on the table with a recommendation by this committee that it be forwarded to Senator Langseth's committee. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And the DVD is wonderful, too.
Yeah. Oh, good. You see that. All right.
We really enjoyed that. Thank you for everything that you do. All right, members, we have another full slate of bills on Thursday and Friday. We've rescheduled our public testimony and several other bills for Friday. So be prepared for a lot of meeting time this week. And the meeting's adjourned.
Really?